another comparative with the Exxon Valdez spill that is harder for people to grasp is that we saw the maps of the Valdez spill, those of us who remember that well, and it looked like a fairly short stretch of coastline because of the Mercator projection of the maps that we generally use. But the Valdez affected a coastline equal to New York City to Miami. It was a heavy crude, and so it globbed up more than this lighter, sweet light crude that's coming out of the well in the Gulf. Although there was sea life along the Alaskan coast there, it wasn't the nursery-type sea life. These estuarine habitats that are being affected and will continue to be affected along the southern coast, because it's a warm coast, because it's those weedy, leafy estuaries, are the places where baby sea life are birthed. And so it's like we're fouling the nest in a very significant way. We're cutting to the base of the food chain. And that's why it's going to be much worse as an impact on wildlife than simply the dead seals and the dead birds that we saw with the Exxon Valdez.
Cecil, you said we're fouling the nest, and that was a very apropos statement because this is breeding season. I heard an expert from the National Audubon Society the other day say that there are literally millions of pairs of nesting birds, all different species, many of which have just done a fairly significant migration to come from parts of Central and South America. They are returning to North America for the breeding season. So you have birds who are tired, who need a respite and need a sanctuary. That's why much of that coastline has actually been protected and preserved in small wildlife sanctuary pockets. And you've got a lot of nesting birds with babies that are too young to fly. So there are going to be some very significant impacts both below the sea, where we can't see what's going on, as well as above the surface. There was also the conjunction of a full moon with some unusually high tides, and that began to push the oil even more up some of these tidal river systems. So there were some very bad natural events that also coincided with a natural breeding season, which has meant that this will be a very significant impact for months and probably years and decades to come.
The economics and the policy of it are also pretty staggering in terms of the impact that it's having and it potentially going to have. We've barely begun to scratch the surface of this cost economically.
Many people call the coast of Louisiana and the Gulf Coast area a sportsman paradise. There is fishing, there is hunting, there is bird watching, paddling. Very few people are going to want to book charter tours to come and boat through oil sheens and muck. There will be, relatively speaking, less wildlife to look at. You certainly won't be interested in catching prized sports fish here at this point. So there's going to be some very significant impact to the tourism and the fishing economy in this area, which this area has been hit by multiple whammies. Some are completely natural in their undertones, and then this one, which of course could be prevented through various different policy measures as well as safety measures.
It's a very, very popular vacation place for people who just like to walk the beach and play the golf courses. And the beaches and the beachfront condos that they've been building like mad for the last couple of decades now will be hugely affected. People will not want to go vacation there for this very same reason that they won't want to go down there to go fishing. Simply to vacation, to hang out on the beach, becomes unappealing when the beach is covered with oil. I heard one wag say, well, you put oil on when you're on the beach anyway.
The comparison between suntan oil and the oil lapping up on the beaches is maybe humorous on one level, but this oil is an extreme irritant and essentially toxic. There's already been any number of health issues involved with the cleanup people, so it's not suntan oil.
I have a friend who used to live and work in Houston, Texas, and he told me that some of the chambers of commerce actually leave small bottles of baby oil in hotels. Those are left for visitors in the hotels to rub on their feet, because sometimes walking along those beaches, you get small tar stains on your feet. And so you actually have to use a baby oil, a mineral oil, to rub them off your feet. I think that most of the people who come to the Panhandle of Florida and other parts of the Eastern Gulf certainly don't intend to walk along beaches that are studded with tar balls and have to rub them off their feet. This is an impact that we will probably only see and understand the full import of with time to come. But we've already seen a preview of coming attractions for what other parts of the Gulf deal with in terms of the oil impacts on the beach.
the current administration just recently essentially endorsed offshore oil drilling as part of a political bid to win support for an energy and climate legislation bill. That doesn't seem to be working out too well, does it, Jen?
It was on March 31st that the president announced a reversal of a longstanding offshore drilling moratorium that had been in place for several decades, in part put in place because of the 1969 disastrous oil spill off the coast of California, but cemented in place after the 1989 Exxon Valdez. This moratorium was allowed to expire by the Democratic-controlled Congress in 2009. Then the president actually announced plans to go forward with offshore drilling as a way of helping to secure America's energy independence. That was the words that he used, and he actually was quoted on April 2nd, 2010, 18 days before this oil rig exploded and sank. He was quoted as saying, offshore drilling is actually very safe. There are few accidents now. That may be true in relative terms if you have thousands of oil rigs out there and you only have one catastrophic accident a year. Maybe in absolute numbers, that seems like a low percentage. But as we all know, in real numbers, this is going to be one of the most devastating, if not the most devastating, environmental impact that this country faces in our history.
However, the United States only has somewhere in the range of 2 to 4% of world reserves, so expanding offshore oil drilling in a nutshell just makes us run out of oil even faster.
On the other hand, there's another way to look at the potential policy impact of this, and that is that it may have occurred just in time. It's reminded everyone of just how bad the oil industry is, just how much damage the oil industry can do. And I think it might help people to focus a little more on the alternatives. It's somehow, we went through this election campaign with the Republican candidates especially saying, drill, baby, drill. They were pushing that we needed to drill off the coast, that we needed to do this to save ourselves from the evil foreign oil supplies and to save ourselves from a lights-out energy future. But the truth is, the amount of oil, even if it's at the maximum that they expect they might find off the coasts of the U.S., isn't enough to make much of a difference in our future. If we had instituted the kind of auto mileage guarantees, if we'd kept the ones in that under the Carter administration, this wouldn't even be a question. We have the opportunity now to tighten up energy standards. We have a number of different ways to go about reducing our energy use into the future. If we would invest the kind of money that's going to be spent on this oil spill in alternative energy, and I'm sorry I used the word spill again, this oil disaster into alternative energy, we probably wouldn't even need the energy that we could get from the oil that's in that basin. For instance, just tightening up efficiency standards across the country. The Rocky Mountain Institute has shown that if all 50 states were as efficient as the three most efficient states in this country, we could shut down 60 coal-fired power plants tomorrow. If we would switch to electrics and to hybrids, as much as there are problems with batteries still, we could cut back on our energy use radically right now. Higher building efficiency standards, we can cut back on the heating needs that burn so much of our fuel oil and natural gas. There are many, many ways to reach the same outcome that don't kill birds, that don't kill fish, in anything like these numbers. We can't create a technological civilization on any scale without having an impact on the world. There's no question. But we can minimize that impact. And I'm hopeful that this disaster will help drive policy. I think it was a political move on his part, hoping to get Republican support. But you don't hear anybody saying drill, baby, drill this week.
I would agree strongly with you, Cecil. I think that what we have had, unfortunately, is 40 years of searching for the wrong solution. After the huge oil spill that occurred in 1969, instead of empowering our engineers to say, what if you could have a car that got 30 and then 40 and then 50 miles per gallon by the year 2010? All of our cars would get the mileage that a Prius gets, or better. But instead, we tasked these engineers with drilling deeper and riskier and trying to provide more oil. So we've actually been searching for the wrong solution. We have the time right here, right now. We have the opportunity to search for the right solution through better fuel economy standards and through better efficiency all around. Not only does that not pollute our environment and kill wildlife, it actually saves consumers money. If you want to put it in the most simple, basic terms, it's actually better for your pocketbook and my pocketbook if we have to spend less money to fuel our cars. So there are so many double wins or triple wins by going this route that we really have gotten off track. And unfortunately, despite an oil spill in 69, despite the oil disaster in 89, and the oil embargo in the early 70s, none of those warning signs were what we needed. And perhaps this will be it. Clearly, unfortunately, the American public bought both the promise and the premise that big oil has given us, the promise that they can make it safe and the premise that we need it. And in fact, in the next 10 to 20 years, we could see radical policy shifts that show us, in fact, we don't need the offshore oil, not from the United States or from other countries as well.
Thanks for tuning in, and please join us next week for the conclusion of our conversation with Jennifer Renix, Federal Policy Coordinator with the Southern Alliance for Clean Energy, and Cecil Bothwell, Environmental Advocate, Author, and Asheville City Council Member. The American Powers Act, or Energy and Climate Bill, has just been made public. This might be the most significant legislation in decades, for better or worse. There are five sections or titles. Title I is called Domestic Clean Energy Development, which primarily promotes the expansion and taxpayer subsidies of nuclear power, offshore oil and gas drilling, coal production, and experimental carbon sequestration technologies. Subtitle A, Section 1101, provides for an expedited procedure for issuing operating licenses for new nuclear reactors that bypass public input and technical and environmental reviews. Section 1102 increases taxpayer funding for the nuclear program called Innovative Technology Loan Guarantee Program up to $54 billion. Section 1103 amends the Energy Policy Act of 2005 to provide taxpayer-funded regulatory risk insurance for 12 reactors at the rate of $500 million per reactor for a total of $6 billion to cover private corporate losses attributed to construction delays. Section 1104 calls for the Secretary of Energy, within a year of the bill's enactment, to designate a high-level nuclear waste reprocessing site at taxpayer expense. While no locations are specified, this is likely going to be at the Savannah River site in our regional neighborhood. Moving on to Subtitle B, Offshore Oil and Gas, Section 1202 authorizes 37.5% revenue sharing with states for offshore oil and gas leasing. An historic break in federal leasing policy and a remarkable incentive for states to promote offshore oil drilling. Section 1203 specifically allows additional revenue sharing in areas adjacent to Alaska. Section 1204 does provide that a state may enact a law prohibiting leasing within 75 miles of its coastline. Subtitle C is coal and carbon sequestration programs funded by the taxpayer. We'll get to that next week. May I suggest that you consider reading this energy and climate bill for yourself, perhaps at a local tea party, to discuss the hundreds of billions of dollars in taxpayer funding being directed to private industries that free markets and even Wall Street won't invest in, or perhaps over coffee with a friend to reflect on how it's possible that expanding subsidies and encouraging dirty energy sources will reduce the impacts of climate change. The founders of our nation specifically advocated for an informed electorate. This is as good a time as any to heed that advice. Our Southern Community is an independent media program. Our Southern Community programs are now available as free downloads at oursoutherncommunity.org. Your comments and programming suggestions are always welcome at info at OurSouthernCommunity.org. Thanks for listening.